Hi, everyone. Welcome to this week's ASF Weekly Science Podcast. This week, I'm happy to report from you from the Meeting on Language and Autism, or MOLA, which is focused on understanding communication in people with autism, how they develop speech and language, and how it is used and understood. This is much more focused than a larger autism meeting. I remember the very first International Meeting for Autism Research. It was tied on to the Society for Neuroscience, but the group was small enough that people could talk to each other, attend posters, and have these focused discussions. Now, INSAR, known as the International Society for Autism Research, is so big that some of these more focused meetings to talk about particular topics and really deep delve into the different facets of autism is really very, very difficult. So this weekend, I'm at a meeting for language and autism, organized in part by former ASF fellow and current friend, Elena Tenenbaum at Duke. While we're talking about language, a different type of language, there was a lot of people at the meeting that misinterpreted a paper authored by Connor Keating and cited it as proof as the entire autism community agreed that identity-first language was respectful, and person-first language was verboten or disrespectful. This happened time and time again at this meeting as proof that the entire community, not just some people, but the entire community, felt that using person-first language was wrong. In fact, Connor Keating said that there was no clear preference and emphasized that people individualize their person-first versus identity-first language based on the preference of the audience they're speaking to. He did not say that everyone should use identity-first language or person-first language. So whoever needs to hear that, I'm saying it now. So I couldn't stay for the whole meeting, but the first day was about language development, emergence, and how children learn to use language. So I first want to highlight a talk that Amy Weatherby gave about describing the course of typical language development. I'm going to give you a brief synopsis because you can learn more at Autism Navigator. The link will be in the podcast summary. I have learned recently that it's not called the podcast summary, it's called the podcast notes. So they'll be in the podcast notes. You can not only see examples of typical development and autism language development, but also emergence of other autism symptoms with the goal of providing examples on how they can be detected and, yes, intervened on. The videos are side by side with typical and autism, so you can compare and contrast. It's really important that new parents look at these videos. New parents, I get it. You don't know what to expect. You don't know what joint attention is. You don't know what's a gesture or a babble or just an utterance. These videos can help. She highlighted three moments in the dawn of language, that is typical language development. First is the onset of intentional communication and conventional signals at 9 months. The baby is saying through their vocalizations, maybe not saying in words, but through their actions, I can use gestures like giving and reaching to get you to do something. Infants are monitoring what is happening and determining if the other person is doing what they want them to do. The second is the onset of first words from gestures and sounds at about 13 months. They are saying, again, not through words, but through their actions, I can use gestures like showing and pointing to get you to notice what I am interested in. I can watch you and imitate what you do and say. I am eager to interact with you and keep the observational learning. I begin to learn by watching others and copying what they do and say. What helps this and what interferes with learning? Language learning is active. You have to work on language development all the time, every day. You can't just spend 10 minutes on it a day. It has to be constant and embedded in daily activities. The third was the onset of language clusters. Now, these are bursts in word category and learning. They're learning about a word a day after 20 months. And they put words into categories like different pets, for example, or different animals. Some animals are pets, some animals are zoo animals. They can use about 50 words and combine two words to convey different meanings. Now, in a child with autism, kids don't express language in the same way. The key is focusing on what the child is doing with their hands at the same time that words are being expressed by the parent and caregiver. This is important and comes up again and again in terms of use of motor activities to inform language. It's key to look at what they're doing with their hands. Parents and caregivers should be encouraged to use the same word in different contexts. Engage the child by working together with hands. Make sure they make eye contact. Use fascination with objects to engage them in a social way. It's not enough to use the same strategies in infants with autism than in typically developing kids. They might be more engaged in the object than they are in the parent or the caregivers, but parents and caregivers need to use that to engage them to utilize social cues for communication. There are many things that influence language development and coaching language at this stage. For example, is the child well regulated? Are they socially connected? Are they looking at faces? Are they responding to bids for interaction? Are they flexible? Are they using generative, creative language? These things are needed at each stage of learning language. So it's important to understand the basic biology of language to provide support and intervention based on that biology. Carol Wilkinson showed data that looked at differences as early as 3 months in EEG, or the activity of the brain, in kids who were later diagnosed with autism. In fact, it turns out it's the change from 3 to 12 months in specific brain waves and how the brain waves sync up that seems to be the most important for language development. There was a great increase in these brain waves associated with worse language development on the Mullen. This isn't just a fluke. There are biological reasons why kids with autism have poor language abilities. Then they moved on to an intervention panel, which included naturalistic developmental behavioral interventions to promote language. Remember when I said that language can't just be supported in bursts of therapy? No, it needs to be supported 24/7, and that means by parents during daily activities. Two of these interventions were highlighted. The first was JASPER, discussed by Connie Cassery from UCLA. JASPER stands for Joint Attention, Symbolic Play, Engagement and Regulation. Engagement and regulation, remember? Those came up during Amy Weatherby's talk, too. Now, this intervention is a naturalistic behavioral intervention, meaning it's child-led, done in naturalistic settings like the home and environment, not the clinic, and should be adapted to the developmental stage of the child. The joint attention refers to the earlier point that the infant or toddler may be engaged with an object. The goal is to get them to want to be engaged with a person. So you start with playing with a toy, and then you can move on to playing with the parent or the person. To make that transition, the child needs access to communication. So you need to engineer learning opportunities to learn different skills. The theory is that joint attention leads to symbolic play that then leads to language. The question is, can you boost language ability by increasing joint attention and engagement via this JASPER intervention? So potentially improving joint attention and engagement can increase access to experience to promote language. This intervention has been shown to be helpful in multiple studies. One group that we don't really talk about in language and autism is those that don't speak, those that are minimally verbal or nonverbal. How do you help them? Well, use of AAC in terms of social communicative utterances seems to be helpful. Now, remember, they're minimally verbal or nonverbal, so you're not going to get full words or sentences, but it does help in terms of these socially communicative utterances. With the device, kids may progress faster, but they both seem to plateau by 36 months. More novel words and commenting rather than requesting language was observed. Also, there was an increase in the child-initiated joint attention, which supports the development of later language. The next early intervention on language was described by Rebecca Landa at the Kennedy Krieger Institute and emphasized the importance of integrating motor skills. Remember, again, Amy Weatherby's presentation talked about look at what your kids are doing with their hands. Dr. Landa pointed out that learning opportunities promote neuroplasticity, which is changes in the brain. The brain needs to be well sculpted and intentionally molded. There just needs to be the perfect balance of attention to promote learning. That means not too much or not too little. This is called the Goldilocks effect. And if you can remember Goldilocks, the not too much and not too little, but just right principle applies too. She stressed the importance of cascading and cascading effects of learning. This means that every experience the baby has or the child leads to the next experience that child has. Then you layer on things, including other people. All these things cascade forward into better language and longer periods of language development. Motor disruption is detectable by 3 months, which predicts language in autism. In the back of the brain is the motor area, and that area is early and persistent, and that area influences the frontal regions of the brain, which are more executive and social. Social communication, learning, and motor function are intertwined in these early weeks of life. Social orienting and vocalizing occur concurrently, not one before the next. So start thinking about what enrichment can be developed at 8 months. Her intervention engages the motor systems and the visual and social engagement initiation systems, which is consistent with making sure, again, what your baby is looking at if it's an object, what they can access, what they're playing with, what they're doing with their hands, and then encouraging them to switch from engaging with objects to engaging more socially and listening to speech and language to learn speech and language. Again, very consistent with what other people were saying. She then describes studies on this approach. Her study was called the Infant Achievement RCT, or Randomized Control Trial. This was delivered to two groups of parents that expressed concern about their kids, and clinicians agreed. They got intervention twice per week for 8 weeks to coach parents on certain functions, and stay tuned for that, or once a week plus a daily check-in. Because they are so early, they were also targeting ADHD, ASD, and developmental delay, because at this age, at 8 months, autism is not the concern. It's everything that's a concern at this early. They picked words that were easy and cheap to match with objects like ball, mommy, etc. The children reached and grabbed and were engaged with objects associated with those words, showing motor and language coordination. The key was to look at that coordinated joint engagement between the hands and the words. Now, because this was a parent-mediated intervention, they looked at parent fidelity. How well were the parents doing it? They did pretty good. But the problem was, around 12 months of age, these kids start walking, and they're no longer sitting around engaging with toys as much. They're running around. They're darting from place to place. So joint engagement using a toy sitting down in a bumbo chair or whatever is not going to work. They're off to do something else. But during this time, language was improved with improved joint attention. Other studies showed that both joint attention and infant sustained attention predicted vocabulary sizes at 15 months. Not joint attention itself, but sustained attention, like for 3 seconds without looking elsewhere. It's not that they're just interested in the same object at the same time and can communicate that, but they keep that attention. Just like with the walking, the interventions have to change over time as children develop. That makes them developmental interventions. Their interests change once they start to walk. Now, wouldn't it be ideal if the parents delivered these interventions? Now, the interventions I've talked about so far are parent-mediated or parent-delivered. But, you know, kids get to be in preschool age and they're spending more time in preschool. So, Dr. Landa built an intervention so it could be integrated into activities involved in normal preschool activities, like art and snack and books and reading. She trained the teachers to do it, but it ends up being harder than it looks. Remember, teachers have a lot to do, and it's really, really hard to get them to change their activities in the classroom. They're dealing with vomit and going to the potty and kids hitting each other. They're facing a lot of challenges, and there's a diversity of abilities in the classroom. Teachers have their own abilities and disabilities, and they can't do all of these prolonged, sustained interventions all day long. So for now, we're working on a better implementation model. So this all ties together by thinking about communication holistically. You have to look at meaningful targets and materials, ongoing support in everyday tasks that focus on joint attention and maintain sustained attention so that the words are paired with objects that kids with autism love so much. It needs to be ongoing, but the challenge is scaling them in this complex, busy world. So the last speaker was really interesting. She talked about echolalia, whether it's meaningful or meaningless. This reminded me of a Vanderpump Rules quote, and if you know what I'm talking about, you know what I'm talking about. But this last section brings into question the whole role of what kids with autism say. Is there hidden meaning in their words? Should we assume that there is meaning even if there's no evidence of meaning? Kids with autism tend to be echolalic. That means they repeat what they have just heard, whether it's a word or a phrase. Sometimes it seems relevant, sometimes it's not. She talked about a theory called Gestalt language development. It is another theoretical style of language development where children start speaking in chunks of language, and this often starts with echolalia. So they say full sentences, but they're echolalic. Do they mean anything? They start saying these things way before that 20-month when kids are putting together sentences or putting together chunks of words. So is it really meaningful? Historically, echolalia, or repeating something verbatim that someone has just said, has been described as meaningless and without communicative function. So the argument over Gestalt language acquisition says that maybe those echolalic expressions do have meaning. Their theory is that at first, children do produce the chunks without a distinction between individual words and without appreciation for intentional syntactic structure. Now, as they learn more about these syntactic rules, they can break down these larger sentences and begin to recombine sentences as word into spontaneous forms. Instead of learning meanings of one word at a time, some children start developing language by memorizing whole phases. Then they actually go backwards. And this can be confused with echolalia. So it assumes that these words strung together before that they would be normally formed, even in typical development, is meaningful. And it's a misunderstanding of language interpretation and expression. It may be more of an intermediate phase that seems incomplete, but it's actually more complete. However, this goes against a lot of theories of language development that show that you have to link words first, and then kids can string words together if they understand what those words mean. There's no real evidence to say that's true. Unfortunately, it's still controversial, which is why I'm mentioning on this podcast. And more unfortunately is that service providers are developing and delivering interventions, even directing families away from AAC devices because they feel that they may detract from Gestalt language processing. They feel like hitting one button, you are not allowing the child to create phrases at that early age. So that was the end of the intervention panel. But I want to provide another perspective on AAC, which instead of being detrimental to language development, was shown to be very helpful to language development, even in four-year-olds who are minimally verbal. Yes, you can teach a typically developing four-year-old to be a buddy so that the intervention can be peer-delivered, not parent-delivered. And those buddies can share an iPad with a peer on the spectrum, which included spontaneous intentional communication in a free play and dyadic play task in autistic four-year-olds. And as long as we're talking about technology, studying language in autism or studying language at all can be very tedious and time-consuming. Think about taking a sentence and breaking down verbs from nouns, thinking about lexical versus pragmatic differences, the categorization of those words, how do you interpret sarcasm, and does context matter? So different groups are using artificial intelligence, which has identified group differences based on autism versus no autism. And it can also potentially make predictions and identify patterns. It might find more nuanced differences than existing methods and detect some sex differences. But how do we measure nonverbal communication or those who are minimally verbal using AI or artificial intelligence? So I have to apologize. This is the end of the podcast. I had to leave early to get home. Apparently, when you're away for three Saturdays in a row, 13-year-old girls are not happy. But as you can tell, I miss topics about adults since mostly the first day was about infants and children. I will say that research on minimally verbal individuals was very well represented at this meeting. And as Martha Stewart says, that's a good thing. But hopefully there were more presentations about non-speaking adults and even adults and adolescents as well. Thank you for listening this week, and I'll talk to you soon.